This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yehiyu Suhib, and here is what's coming up on a special pre-recorded show today, taking a look at how the coronavirus pandemic has affected the African continent.
The region as a whole has seen a sharp contraction due to COVID-related recessions in their major export markets and softening of commodity prices due to decreased global demand. The effects of lockdowns in the early stages of the crisis were negative as well.
That's Professor Colin Hendricks talking about the economic effects of COVID-19 on African states. And we hear again a personal story about loss in the pandemic. All these and more coming up on Africa News Tonight. Welcome to this special pre-recorded program of African News Tonight. We are going to take a deep look at the battle against the coronavirus pandemic. Just a year ago, medical workers in the city of Wuhan, China, discovered a novel virus causing severe illness in many patients. It is the coronavirus designated SARS-CoV-2, the virus that causes COVID-19. The disease rapidly spread around the world, and on March 11th, the World Health Organization declared COVID-19 could be characterized as a pandemic. Tens of millions of people have been infected, and nearly 2 million have died from COVID-19 by late December. In the years since it was discovered, the world has learned much about this new disease. VOA's Steve Miller spoke with Dr. Zach Jenkins, who maintains a clinical practice in infectious disease at Atrium Medical Center and Miami Valley Hospital in the U.S. state of Ohio. He began their conversation by asking Dr. Jenkins how far our understanding of the virus has come during the past year.
You know, this is really the first coronavirus that I think, at least in recent memory, we've seen impact people so significantly. We know that there's a significant mortality found with this virus in the elderly and those who are considered higher risk that we wouldn't normally see with the coronavirus. And what makes it so different than the annual flu that we would typically run into? It has a lot of abnormal things that it causes that we don't typically see in a flu. So, for example, there are a lot of microvascular clots that occur as a result of this particular virus, leading to things like stroke, to heart attacks, to pulmonary emboli. So all these complications we really see with this particular virus that we don't normally see with the flu. It is seen to be definitely more associated with mortality than the flu in people that are in that older population group. A little bit less in terms of mortality compared to the flu when it comes to those who are younger. So I would say those would be the biggest differences that we've observed.
And, you know, we have seen the deployment of vaccines and the production of those vaccines far faster than other viruses that have been around, which really speaks to the level of research conducted on SARS-CoV-2, the virus that causes COVID-19. But, you know, in your opinion, as someone who works in the infectious disease space, where are the knowledge gaps, if any, that remain?
Well, there are a few things with regards to the vaccine that we still don't know. So we had the Pfizer vaccine that was approved. With the Pfizer vaccine, we don't necessarily know how it will perform in patients who are pregnant or in children. So we don't have that data at this point in time. Another important thing is the phase 3 trial that they used for the Pfizer vaccine to work towards approval only looked at its ability to prevent symptomatic illness. It didn't actually investigate whether or not it was able to prevent asymptomatic transmission. And why that's important is we know about 40% of transmission with COVID-19 tends to be in people who don't have any symptoms at all. So that was actually a big sticking point with the FDA panelists who made this decision. And they really wanted Pfizer to gather some more data on that before they went about unblinding their study participants to possibly receive the vaccine if they hadn't already. So I think that that's an important thing to kind of take away. If we get that transmission data, why that's so important for us, we'll be able to move to the state of those who've received both doses of the vaccine could potentially not have to wear masks anymore. And they wouldn't necessarily have to go about some of these procedures. So there's some areas in knowledge that we still are kind of lacking with regards to that. When it comes to other areas related to COVID, we don't quite understand why it causes all of the clotting, the blood clotting that it seems to be causing in people, which makes it a little bit difficult as far as preventing those issues from happening. We know, too, that blood thinners we would typically use to prevent clotting, but we don't know whether we should be using high doses that we would use to treat clots to prevent these things from happening, or just lower doses like we would normally use with most other people who are prone to clotting. And then there are a lot of things when it comes to therapeutics as well. There's still some unknowns. We have some things in development, some other artificial antibodies similar to the one that President Trump received. We also have some other theoretical medications that may hit the market, and we're still looking at repurposing older medications that are out there. So at this point in time, the data on that front is a little bit lacking.
Dr. Zach Jenkins practices medicine in the state of Ohio. He was speaking with my colleague, Steve Miller. Four reasons that scientists have not yet fully identified. The African continent has been less badly hit by the coronavirus pandemic than many other regions of the world. In total, the World Health Organization reports that it has experienced just under 2 million cases and about 40,000 deaths. In comparison, the United States has reported more than 18 million cases and about 320,000 deaths, the most of any country. Still, the pandemic has overwhelmed some countries' medical systems, shattered schools, and battered already fragile economies. And in recent weeks, the continent has seen rapidly spreading outbreaks in some region, such as South Africa, where confirmed cases have soared to more than 10,000 a day in recent weeks, up from fewer than 1,000 a day in early November. The African Centers for Disease Control have warned that the continent may be headed to a new surge in cases, much the way Europe and the Americas have. As COVID-19 vaccines roll out in Europe and the U.S., offering hope from the devastation of the coronavirus pandemic on communities and businesses, how has African economies fared and what are the continent's challenges for a rebound? VOA's Chinedu Ofor spoke with Professor Cullen Hendricks of the Joseph Corbell School of International Studies, University of Colorado, and non-resident senior fellow of the Peterson Institute for International Economics.
Overall, I think the region has been spared some of the very, very widespread loss of life due to COVID that we've seen in other regions. Even the hardest hit country, which has been South Africa, has seen impacts that are roughly equivalent to those that we're seeing in Canada, which is about 40 deaths per 100,000 people. Of course, that's tragic, but the magnitude of the tragedy is somewhat diminished in relative, at least, to some other countries and regions that have been much more impacted. North Africa is the region's second hardest hit sub-region, and its highest death totals are roughly equivalent to those that we're seeing in Denmark. So in terms of the performance of the public health systems, and in terms of loss of life, which is always catastrophic, the region has been somewhat spared. It's likely that the magnitude of the effects have been undercounted somewhat, especially in the lesser developed countries where testing may be more difficult due to gaps in healthcare systems. But the urbanization part of the story may actually work in the region's favor, as it has in places like New Zealand and Australia. Less densely populated areas tend to have less spread. And also Africa's relative youth as a region is working in its favor as well, given that the worst health effects of COVID are on the elderly. In terms of the economic effects, the region as a whole has seen a sharp contraction due to COVID-related recessions in their major export markets and softening of commodity prices due to decreased global demand. The effects of lockdowns in the early stages of the crisis were negative as well, as were the political ramifications. The outlook for Southern Africa moving forward is bad, but it was relatively bad going into the crisis. So, for instance, South Africa had 30% at the outset of the crisis.
When do you think the rebound would come, if possible?
I mean, the rebound will come when the rebound comes in major export markets, frankly. Once the world economy rebounds significantly, African economy will rebound as well. Obviously, the relations outside of the region in terms of exports are going to be significant, but so will a resumption of normal economic activity within the region, even though levels of inter-regional trade are relatively low. When it does rebound, which hopefully will be in the second or third, maybe fourth quarter of this year, 2021, it will rebound to at least in South Africa, about a 2% growth rate in terms of GDP.
Do you think when the rebound comes, it's going to be business as usual, or as a result of the pandemic, things might be just a little bit different from what we used to know?
Coming on the heels of the financial crisis earlier this decade as well, I think that there's broad recognition within the economies of Africa that their orientation towards global markets and towards major export markets in Europe and in Asia and in North America is not necessarily a sustainable path moving forward. And I think that you're going to see broad recognition and broad moves towards reducing barriers to international trade and increasing intra-regional trade and investment to better link the African economies under a mantle of shared prosperity and a prosperous future.
Will it be effective for some of these African countries to invest in infrastructure or just social programs as a result of the pandemic?
The best case scenario would be all of the above in terms of investments in basic infrastructure, social services being important. I think that for long-term sustainability, making fundamental investments in basic infrastructure is important, but also investing in the human capital in terms of education and better access to healthcare is fundamentally going to develop the region's most important resource, and that's its people.
That's Professor Colin Hendricks of the Joseph Corbell School of International Studies at the University of Colorado and non-resident senior fellow of the Peterson Institute for International Economics in Washington, D.C. He was speaking from Denver. On the African continent, COVID-19 has hit South Africa the hardest. The country has recorded more than 1 million cases and about 25,000 deaths. The restriction imposed during South Africa's battle with COVID-19 has left lasting damage on untold numbers of South Africans, including the nation's already pinched middle class. According to a United Nations study, more than a third of the Rainbow Nation's middle class households have been pushed into vulnerability. VOA's Anita Powell caught up with one university-educated young South African who said his middle class dreams have been shattered.
Like many South Africans, Sehofatso Balerleng had a tough year as his nation imposed strict coronavirus measures at the cost of the already struggling economy. He was laid off in June and moved in with family.
Things became difficult even at home. I couldn't provide for my family the way that I used to. And at the time, I lived with my grandfather and my father, and none of them are employed. So we basically had to survive on the grants that they were receiving from the government.
Millions of South Africans are telling a similar story this year. The nation's 5-week hard lockdown kept countless workers from physically going to work. The government estimates that as many as 3 million people work in the informal economy. But Balerleng is the rare South African with a college degree, an emblem of the dream of a robust black middle class. A UN report estimates that as many as 34% of South Africa's middle class households are now vulnerable. The pandemic dealt a blow to an already contracting economy with record unemployment levels, says economist Dawie Root.
Things were pretty bad even before the beginning of this year. And then we had this virus and we had lockdown and everything went from bad to really, really bad. And I think the South African economy today is not even in a recession, it's actually in a deep depression.
President Cyril Ramaphosa acknowledged the damage the pandemic has wrought and has urged patience. When he announced a hard lockdown earlier this year, he also announced a raft of economic stimulus measures, mostly aimed at poor households.
History will absolve me because the determination to put things right is there. And we may be moving at a slow pace, and we may be moving at a pace where people, you know, want faster movement. But we are painstakingly putting things right.
But many South Africans say it isn't enough. Balerleng couldn't qualify for unemployment benefits because he had not been unemployed for 3 months at the time of his application.
I think, unfortunately, there's a certain perspective that even though you're part of the middle class, you would still be able to survive the pandemic, even though you just lost your job. Or there's always the assumption that there's still money put somewhere for you to survive, even if it's not for long enough. But there still is something for you to survive on until a certain time. And unfortunately, that's not really the case.
Root says he is fundamentally more worried about the poor, who have felt the worst effects. And he said things won't improve unless the government does something drastic that will, again, probably hurt the middle class and the 2 million civil servants who are part of it.
There's only one thing that the Minister of Finance can do. There's really only one thing. He must spend less money. And inevitably, that means he must spend less money on people. That means he must start cutting, he must start closing down things. He must close down state-owned enterprises. He must start fire a lot of civil servants, and he must pay the rest less. That is what must happen. And that is what is going to happen. Either you do it now while you've still got some control, or inflation is going to do that for you over time eventually.
Valera Lang has landed on his feet for now, with a job at a government hospital. But will things improve for him in 2021? He's optimistic, but the numbers tell a different story. Anita Powell, VOA News, Johannesburg.
You're listening to African News Tonight. I'm Yehiye Suhib in Washington. More than anything else, COVID-19 is about people who contracted the virus, the people they love, and the people who care for them. Earlier in the outbreak, Darren Taylor in Johannesburg brought us the story of one family's journey through the despair of COVID-19. We are bringing you their story again today, and we have the first part of the three-part series.
About a month ago, 61-year-old teacher Yasmin Hafaji came home from her job at a school in Cape Town feeling extremely tired. Her younger sister, Fazila Abrams, says Hafaji was also battling to breathe, but thought it was just a bad bout of asthma.
Her husband starts getting ill by the Thursday also.
The following Tuesday was Abrams' birthday. South Africa was locked down because of COVID-19, so her family played a video of birthday wishes for her using the Zoom platform.
Right at the end of that video, I said to them, but where's my sister? She's not sending me a message. And my daughter said, Mommy, she was not well last night. And I got so angry.
Abrams fetched Hafaji to take her to a hospital.
I put her in a car, dressed her. She was ill. I knew I was putting myself at risk, but you know, this is what we do for family. And
her sister's husband, Shiraz, was also sick, so she took both of them. A nurse led them inside the hospital and later returned to speak with Abrams.
She brought the information back and said they've been admitted to an ICU. The next morning, my sister sent us a message to say they're COVID positive.
After that, Abram says she could hardly find anything out about her sister and brother-in-law.
For 3 days, I do not get information other than the nurses saying to me they're stable. But what does stable mean in an ICU situation?
Abram says she was beside herself with anxiety.
I had no way to go. What else do I do? I couldn't get through to my sister and her husband and know what's happening. I have the children. I'm trying to hold those children together. I'm trying to support them. And they're leaning on me. I'm in isolation. But I can't get through to people.
In desperation, Abrams, a medical researcher with a PhD, reached a hospital manager and referred to herself as Dr. Fazila Abrams.
I hate it. I think titles are not important. She doesn't want to hear this now when I say to her, I'm Dr. Abrams. I have had no information about my sister. The information is just that we can't tell you. You must speak to the doctor. And this doctor's not speaking to me.
Shortly after, says Abrams, the doctor called about her sister's and brother-in-law's conditions.
The doctor says critical. My sister is better. She's talking to us. She's on the phone now with us. But the prognosis is not good for him.
Abrams' brother-in-law died shortly after VOA interviewed her. She believes the only reason she got attention at the hospital is because she's a doctor herself.
How many ICU people are there in public and private ICU that hasn't got the privilege I have of using my title and the privilege I have to have loads of airtime, to spend hours on the phone. People don't. They just.
Abrams wants hospitals to appoint COVID-19 patient advocacy officers who would be tasked with communicating with relatives about their loved ones. In her case, even bad news was better than no news at all. For VOA News, I'm Darren Taylor in Johannesburg.
Vaccines against COVID-19 are being rolled out in several countries, including the United Kingdom, the United States, Canada, China, Russia, the United Arab Emirates, and Saudi Arabia. But poorer countries are still waiting. The World Health Organization set up an initiative known as COVAX to give poorer nations access to COVID-19 vaccines, but it is short on cash, with only enough for a fraction of the 2 billion doses it hopes to buy over the next year. Some experts say the chances that coronavirus shots will be shared fairly between rich nations and the rest are fading. For more, we have VOA's Chinedu Ofor once again speaking with Kate Elder, Senior Vaccines Policy Advisor for the group Doctors Without Borders Access Campaign in New York.
COVID-19 might be new. The issues surrounding access to these vaccines that are now coming rapidly, but those issues are not new. I mean, these are issues that we see time and time again that MSF sees in the medical field in terms of access to medicines, diagnostics, or vaccines because of the way the current research and development and biomedical innovation system is set up, where we allow pharmaceutical companies to be the ones that really get to dictate who gets access to these medical tools, at what prices, and at what time frame. What we typically see in the field of vaccines and other medical tools, where the wealthiest countries get access to vaccines first, and then the poorest countries much further down the line with a significant time lag get access to vaccines.
What are the options or alternatives open to either countries or citizens of these poorer countries?
I mean, in terms of options for them getting access to COVID-19 vaccines, I think the very sobering reality is that sadly, they don't have many options. Their governments don't represent an attractive customer to pharmaceutical corporations that are looking to make money off of COVID-19 vaccines. The poorest countries of the world are not the countries that pharmaceutical corporations are running to try and engage in advance purchase arrangements with. So the people in these countries, really, the risk is that they are left behind. Again, a situation that we see just regularly in the work that MSF does and the work that we try to do to access medical tools for the populations that we serve. So, I mean, that's the risk in terms of people. In terms of what these governments can do, what we need is governments of developing countries to be using their voice. One, to be using their voice to call foul on the way things are happening right now with access to COVID-19 vaccines. They need to speak up. They need to talk about these inequities. They need to talk about their concerns with the Gavi-led COVAX facility, that it might not be delivering vaccines to them anytime soon. They need to talk about what the world should be doing to put in check this power imbalance, with pharmaceutical corporations having just so much power and seemingly the people having so little and truly being at the mercy of the system. And governments as well need to use the tools that they have available to safeguard the public's health. Right now, there's a series of very important initiatives happening at global institutions, including what's happening right now at the World Trade Organization. At the WTO in Geneva, the governments of South Africa and India have spearheaded an initiative to ask for a very exceptional waiver of intellectual property because of the severity of this global pandemic. South Africa and India and now have garnered co-sponsors from other governments and much support from about 100 governments around the world, are talking about the need to do things differently in terms of treatment of intellectual property and the monopolies that intellectual property awards to pharmaceutical companies because of the severity of this pandemic. So governments want to be able to waive certain intellectual property protections because of this public health crisis so that we can scale up quickly availability of medicines, diagnostics, and vaccines.
That was Kate Elder with Doctors Without Borders, or Médecins Sans Frontières. She was speaking with Chinedu Ofor. And that wraps up this special pre-recorded edition of African News Tonight, looking at how the coronavirus pandemic has affected Africa. I'm Yehius Wuhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Mokibilia Baro, thank you again for tuning in and choosing the Voice of America.